Hey folks, I'm Denise Howell, and you're about to join us on This Week in Law, where I'm joined by Stefan Spida and Matt Curtis. We're going to talk about social media and the First Amendment, California's new net neutrality law, the gig economy and independent contractors versus employees, copyright rhetoric getting snarky, and Goop laying a jade egg, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiLT.
This is TWiLT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Spida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 433, recorded September 7th, 2018. Too bad for Bing. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. It's been a busy, busy week as folks have been testifying in Congress, etc. We have much to discuss. I've got two of my wonderful co-hosts here on the show with me today. Stefan Spida, who's a lawyer at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, is here. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Denise.
Great to see you again. How's it going?
It's going great. I'm really excited for today's show.
No, me too. And Matt Curtis is here. Matt is a law student on hiatus from Notre Dame who is doing a startup at the moment. He's actually moved himself out to California doing the startup dance with his company, Pareto Life Sciences, which is doing really cool stuff. Remind us what Pareto does, Matt.
So Pareto is a marketplace for stem cells for the treatment of leukemia, lymphoma, and anemia. And actually, we were out in California for the summer at Y Combinator and are done with that for the summer. So back in Indiana and working hard and keeping it rolling.
Did you play "I'm Going Back to Indiana" when you headed back?
If I had a version of yours, I definitely would have played that. Otherwise, I was not willing to submit myself to that.
All right. I'll do the whole thing for you so you can play it in the car next time. Yeah. All right. So let's move on and talk about things in the realm of legislation, regulation, and policy, because there is much afoot there these days. I doubt that any of us have listened to all of the Kavanaugh hearing this week, but there has been a hearing, in case you've missed it, going on in Congress for the potential new Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I also think it's worth noting, just before we go any deeper or into any substance at all, that we are not only inaugurating perhaps the era of a new Supreme Court justice, but the era of Supreme Court justices with names like Brett. He is young enough to be part of the Brett generation. I've always thought that that was an interesting little factoid about this particular judicial candidate. Anyway, so he's been on the stand for several days answering many, many questions, not very many of them about technology, but technology did come up. And in fact, in our discussion points for the show today, if you want to hear the specific tidbits of technology-related testimony that happened in these hearings, I've put in the C-SPAN links. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, there is video and transcripts available over at C-SPAN, and you can even search them. So the search that I did was for the term technology, but it might also be useful to search for Fourth Amendment or First Amendment, because those things came up together for Judge Kavanaugh as he was testifying. So you might want to do some of your own searching and see if you find even more than I was able to, because obviously there was a lot of testimony and very little of it had to do with tech law, policy, privacy, but some of it did. So what we do know is there was a session with Senator Flake and Judge Kavanaugh where they basically talked about how important these issues will be for the Supreme Court going forward. Talked about the Carpenter and Riley decisions from the Supreme Court, also the Jones decision, which Judge Kavanaugh had a role in as a DC Circuit judge. and didn't tell us anything too earth-shattering or that we didn't know before, but just acknowledged specifically, and here's a quote from Judge Kavanaugh, "I think going forward, as I've said, these hearings," he is referring to the hearings, "are backward-looking hearings sometimes, but the forward-looking question you ask is, I think, a very important one about the change in Fourth Amendment, not doctrine, but the change in technology that in turn requires us to understand it as we apply Fourth Amendment doctrine going forward, and First Amendment free speech principles as well. Our conception of free speech will have to take account of the technological developments as well." So these things were on his mind as he was testifying about technology before the Judiciary Committee this week. Matt, did you find anything particularly interesting or noteworthy about Judge Kavanaugh for the time being's opinions on these issues?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that he did the normal song and dance of judicial nominees of answering backward looking. I think that the reason he gave specific impetus on the question of technological changes because the Carpenter case was premised upon that the changes in technology have made it so that your Fourth Amendment, it does protect you in some instances from continual tracking. So I think that that's why he jumped into that. Just to, you know, I think the interesting thing about this whole confirmation hearing is that, you know, if we recall, you know, this isn't historical practice until the 1950s or 1940s when Justice Frankfurter went before the Senate committee to go through this. And it's really a question of like, you know, these individuals who are going up for nomination, they know how to toe the line and not give something away, right or wrong. And that's really what they're incentivized to do. And so it's a long couple days of political pandering, which is somewhat disappointing when people do want to know about how their justice will rule on this, but it's the justice, you know, can't say how they'll rule. So it's an interesting time.
Yeah, it is. Issues, it's a time too for the senators to showcase or grandstand maybe for their constituents that they're paying attention to certain issues that they know are important, particularly as we head toward the midterm elections this November. Stefan, anything about Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that you learned from listening in to any of this?
I think what I found more striking about this hearing, like the previous hearings with the more recent Supreme Court judges, is that there's a sort of sense of irony about the fact that someone who's essentially applying for the job of being overseeing the most sophisticated court system in the world, if not history, has to go through essentially a medieval ordeal and recite a tightly bound script and try not to say anything at all while being televised and appearing in front of a bunch of intimidating senators. And that I tend not to take the substance of what the judges are saying under those circumstances very seriously because of the circumstances. It makes it hard for me to focus on what they're saying because essentially they're trying their best not to say anything. And it's just a strange spectacle. And it's, as a Canadian, I find it a little bit odd. We don't have the same practice in Canada, and it's very performative and it's very, I dare say, shallow. And so it's hard for me to look at what they're saying and see it as anything other than, you know, how many times can I move my lips without saying anything?
How does it work in Canada?
Oh, you know, they just go out to the ice fishing hut and they cut the ground. Whoever catches the biggest trout.
All right, I walked right into that ice hole. So,
it's just, I don't know. I think that actually the Stephen Harper, who was a prime minister a couple of prime ministers ago, I think he tried to introduce this American style performance piece. But in the past, the way that it worked was, you know, the prime minister would get a set of recommendations and act on them and appoint the justice. And it was a much more behind the scenes process. Some people might criticize it as being less transparent, but it's kind of a mirror image of the question of, you know, is justice served by having cameras in the courtroom? I mean, sometimes transparency has a an effect where it essentially makes the people being observed behave in ways that they wouldn't otherwise behave, and not necessarily in a good way. And I think as long as you trust your decision makers, allowing them to undergo the deliberative process without the song and dance can actually be a way of getting better results. And, you know, not to denigrate the quality of the justices in the U.S., I think, you know, for the most part, they're even if you don't agree with them, they're good. The process, I just think, you know, a certain kind of person who maybe would be a great judge is never going to make it on the bench because of just the rigmarole they have to go through, and this kind of pseudo transparency that it entails, I find just slightly bizarre.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I guess I keep holding out hope that substantive tidbits creep in, just because it's such a lengthy process and there's so much questioning and people get tired. But Kavanaugh is pretty good at towing the line for what he, you know, the talking points he wants to get out there and protecting himself as a potential future jurist on the Supreme Court. Another senator that got into technological issues with him was Senator Leahy, who brought up a couple of things. He brought up a dissent that Judge Kavanaugh had written in the Jones case at the D.C. Circuit level before the Supreme Court had weighed in, and pulled out some language from that dissent that was pretty provocative. He didn't actually author the dissent, but he joined in it. And that dissent talked about Americans' expectation of privacy in a person's movement outside their home being basically zero. So Leahy thought that was problematic and wanted an explanation on that. He didn't really get much of one, except for that, of course, the Supreme Court ultimately ruled on that case and found otherwise. And he got an assurance, I guess, from Judge Kavanaugh that Supreme Court case law seems to be developing in a way that's consistent with Senator Leahy's concerns about privacy. And he mentioned Riley, Carpenter, and Jones, those three recent decisions. I do, you know, a dissent that says that a person's expectation of privacy in their movement outside their home is basically zero, I think is a little bit less than nuanced enough for today's realities. We certainly have, if you go back to a few years ago when the upskirting cases began to be prominent and we had to question whether people had an expectation of privacy outside their home, but in a place where they would expect privacy, restroom, locker room, et cetera. That certainly was something that courts were quick to embrace and say, yes, we don't want people to be able to say that there's no expectation of privacy and be able to do that kind of conduct. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I think that when you're talking about such vague ideas as an expectation of privacy for like a whole population, it's hard to not think of the judicial determination on a more political grounds. For instance, you know, since that question is outcome determinative in the case of whether, you know, tracking somebody for their movements, you know, X number of days after this, you have to, you know, your determination of whether you think that's legal sometimes skews your determination of is the general person's expectation of walking around the streets that people know where they are. And so that's, you know, that's the one where, you know, when you look at real politics in courts, you know, you can see where when you're, you know, by nature of history, your decision point in the case is based upon what is this expectation of privacy for a person in the public. That's, you know, the results are outcome determinative. So it's an interesting situation. But in terms of his statement, then that's what the courts, the decisions have been going through in Carpenter and such. That's fact. That doesn't actually mean that he's, even though he said to the senator that this is the trend in the cases and that this is the way it's decided, that's no actual guarantee that he has to rule on that basis in the future. That's what the cases have been decided upon. So that's true. But that really. In terms of how he judges moving forward, that shouldn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, anything about privacy in a person's movements? Or the other thing he discussed with Senator Leahy was the fact that I think the D.C. Circuit was also involved in Carpenter, and the what Senator Leahy was concerned with there was statements about Dragnet collection of telephone data that Judge Kavanaugh seemed to be on board with for purposes of law enforcement goals. And then he backtracked and said, of course, I said what I said before Carpenter was decided, and I would decide consistent with the Supreme Court's precedent. Any thoughts?
I'm frankly relieved anytime that the court acknowledges that constitutional rights are interpreted in light of contemporary expectations. I find it a bit of a relief that they didn't just ask, or Judge Kavanaugh didn't simply say, "Well, what did the founding fathers think about digital privacy?" and leave it at that. Look, it's a complicated question. I think if I were to dig into the briefing, I'm sure I could convince myself that every iteration of possible outcome is the right one, depending on which hat I was wearing at the time. I think the factual question of what expectation of privacy should a reasonable person have when they're moving around outside with a cell phone, I think may inform legal outcomes. But I think we shouldn't think about these things in such a snapshot way, because the technology is going to evolve very quickly. And if we commit ourselves to a particular view that's teed off of the timing of a particular piece of litigation that gets its way up to the Supreme Court, and then a decision is made on that basis, and then we start applying the law based on that technology as it existed at the time, and then there are advances, and 3 or 4 years later, people's expectations change with those advances, we're going to have to just keep relitigating this. So it sounds to me like a more thoughtful approach would be to go through Congress and establish some principles that reflect a more cohesive understanding of what people's rights are and codify those rights in legislation, and then use that legislation as a much more flexible and publicly reviewable body of law that can address these concerns. Because I think attempting to read into constitutional protections parameters based on people's fluctuating expectations is going to be unsatisfying in the short and long run. So I think we can do better than that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you feel like Congress should play that role, or the states, or both?
I find that in American discourse, saying Congress should do that is a polite way of saying this is never going to happen, and I'm comfortable with the status quo. So I'm going to punt this to the federal legislative body, knowing that they're never going to do anything about it. And so, accounting for that, so take that out of the equation, and yes, I do think federal legislators should do something about this, but they should actually do something about it and not just say they should do something about it with the expectation that they're not going to do anything. I think the states, I don't know enough about the federalism issues here, whether the states have what competencies the states have in this regard, but I think if California wanted to take the lead on this, I think it's a great state with a lot of thoughtful legislative ideas, and I think they could do a good job trying to articulate some of the concerns, and then it's up to the other states to decide whether they want to follow or not. And I think having that kind of discourse, like you're seeing with net neutrality, for example, is a good way to take a complicated, contemporary, technology-focused issue and have the discussion pitched to a level that is a little bit more accessible and a little bit more amenable to contemporary analysis than something like litigation, which has to wind its way through the courts and is subject to a very different type of scrutiny. And so it would be very encouraging to me to see legislation that does a more robust job of accounting for these concerns than you can maybe get away with in briefing.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and California has started down that path, with several pieces of privacy legislation over the year. The most recent being the California Consumer Privacy Act we just enacted here, which we haven't talked about that much on the show because, frankly, I'm still trying to get my head around it, and I'd like to get a guest on who has done so more extensively before we delve into it. But it's basically, I'd say it's modeled on the GDPR. It's like the GDPR. It's got its issues for sure. It's certainly come under fire for being overbroad and sweeping in businesses that probably shouldn't be covered by it. But, again, you don't always get everything you want. I think President Obama just said that in a speech today that you shouldn't be reluctant to praise progress, even if you haven't gotten everything that you need. So maybe that will be a good step in the right direction. You're correct to be concerned about how it will fare when it comes under attack for being something that might be more properly governed by the federal government or enacted by the federal government. And I guess the same goes for the net neutrality bill that we just enacted in California. It's passed all the legislative bodies, and now Governor Brown will need to sign it into law on September 30th for it to take effect. But assuming that happens, and I haven't heard any indication that that's not going to happen, California will be the first state to reinstate net neutrality following its rollback by the FCC this last June. It would prohibit internet service providers from blocking or throttling lawful traffic, from requiring fees from websites or online services to deliver or prioritize their traffic to consumers. It would also impose limits on data cap exemptions. That's the zero rating term you've heard before. And says also that ISPs may not attempt to evade net neutrality protections by slowing down traffic at network interconnection points. So it is trying to put net neutrality back into place. And we'll have to see what happens after September 30th as various ISPs attempt to comply with it. Matt, any thoughts on California taking this step?
Yeah, I think that, the open question remains, under the federal separation of powers issue of or state federal powers issues when Congress actually told the FCC that they couldn't regulate on this, they put it back in the hands of the FTC. Did that have the effect of controlling the field and meaning that states cannot enact laws as a result of this? And I think that will go to litigation. And I think the difference, when we talk about what is the proper role of the state and the federal government in this, the difference in this case from like a Fourth Amendment privacy protection is that in the Fourth Amendment context, you're basically passing laws to limit what the government can do in tracking individuals or prosecuting individuals or some sort of thing of that. So you're telling yourself what you can do when you're writing laws. So it seems like there has to be a balance of, the states have to tell their police departments what they can't do, and the federal has to tell the FBI and, the other federal prosecutors what they can't do. And that's why, that's why I think that litigation is so attractive, because if you make it a constitutional issue, then everyone has to follow that constitutional norm. On the other hand, with the ISPs and net neutrality, it is more complicated when you have a state-by-state basis for that, because you are telling outside third parties, private companies, what they can and cannot do. And under the commerce power, there's been some instances where the courts have said that, no, you can't, if the court has spoken, or if the if Congress has spoken on the issue, then states cannot regulate here, and it's preempted by the federal government. So I think that'll be an interesting case that will inevitably come up with California's adoption of this.
Right, and getting back to Judge Kavanaugh for just a minute, there might be another reason why California's new law comes under fire if we delve back into his jurisprudence, because one of the things that comes up when you look at his various decisions that he's authored or participated in over the years that touch on technology and telecommunications is he was a lone voice on the D.C. Circuit that authored a dissenting opinion that agreed with Verizon in that particular case, that there was a First Amendment argument to be made as to why net neutrality was unconstitutional and should not be applied to ISPs. Most commentators who've read through the briefs there and know the arguments made in the net neutrality litigation over the years consider that just sort of a throwaway argument. Oftentimes lawyers will, as they're briefing cases, they will take all kinds of arguments, some of which they consider quite strong, some of which they consider, you know, good faith, that they can make the argument, but they kind of expect it to get shot down. They think it's maybe not as strong as some of their other arguments, that maybe they even think it's flimsy. We don't know what they think, but they're putting it in because they think that perhaps it could resonate with somebody on the panel of judges hearing their case. And this particular First Amendment issue resonated with Judge Kavanaugh, and he picked up on it and wrote a dissent that's actually quite timely with some other points that have happened this week, other goings on in Washington this week, as Jeff Sessions has announced a potential investigation of Silicon Valley companies for being biased in their content control. What Judge Kavanaugh said at the time about net neutrality is that, and he emphasized a couple of times the notion of market power, that if you're not able to show that a company has dominant market power in some way, and this is what he writes, the government must keep its hands off the editorial decisions of internet service providers. Again, he emphasizes the market power aspect. Absent a showing of market power, the government may not tell internet service providers how to exercise their editorial discretion about what content to carry or favor any more than the government can tell Amazon or Politics and Prose what books to promote, or tell the Washington Post or the Drudge Report what columns to carry, or tell ESPN or the NFL Network what games to show, or tell how appealing — that's a blog, by the way, and I know the blogger, and I'm sure he was thrilled to be mentioned in this opinion — or bench memos what articles to feature, or tell Twitter or YouTube what videos to post, or tell Facebook or Google what content to favor. So he talks about market power as something that could convince him otherwise. If you could show that the one of those entities, such as an ISP, has dominant market power and is basically shutting out the competition, he seems to assume that there's a public square aspect to what's going on, both with an ISP providing access to the internet and to content providers that either help you find material on the internet or help you put your own material on the internet. So this, I think, could come up again. The fact that he's hitched onto this First Amendment article, you could see someone putting that into a brief challenging the California Act and saying, you know, assuming Judge Kavanaugh gets appointed to the Supreme Court, confirmed to the Supreme Court, he might well have the opportunity to flesh out his thoughts on that point with respect to California. Anybody want to add anything else there? No?
Drudge Report.
Yes?
I love that he mentions the Drudge Report in that opinion. I mean, yeah. did he run out of wacky conservative blogs? Then was Breitbart not up to being referenced? I mean, I just don't.
It was I don't few know years what. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know that that's lingering out there. What else should we talk about? I guess it's worth mentioning that, you know, we're going to get around to what Jeff Sessions announced on Wednesday this week. In a moment, we're going to talk about the First Amendment and various internet platforms and how the government may decide to wade into how they do their content moderation. But before we do that, as long as we're talking about the FCC and net neutrality, we should mention that Ajit Pai seems to be on board with Jeff Sessions and has done a blog post on Medium, not cross-posted to the FCC blog, which I guess he generally does, talking about how it may be time for tighter rules on Silicon Valley. And the interesting little twist to this is there was a telecommunications lobby group called US Telecom, which, oopsie, accidentally emailed internal documents to TechDirt's Mike Masnick, who promptly published them along with his own inimitable analysis. And what's interesting is how closely Chairman Pai's post to Medium tracks those talking points that came out earlier and were sent to Mike Masnick. So Ajit Pai seems to be patting himself on the back for the fact that the ISPs seem to be doing a fabulous job with consumer data and privacy. And it's really this other aspect, these Silicon Valley companies that might need some more attention and regulation. So he's not the only person in Washington singing that song these days. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that, you know, from a regulatory perspective, they want to take a very hands-off approach with the ISPs, and right or wrong, you know, with the net neutrality and saying that, look, leave it to private hands to be able to determine this. But when it comes to the more political aspects of what's going on, and they seem to want to take a greater step into regulating, you know, who can be on these public forums, who can't, you know, there's at least the idea in the water that it's, you know, against conservatives or against liberals or against more, you know, mainstream ideas are only allowed. And it seems like, at least from a theoretical perspective, is their stance is that you know, the market should take care of these things, and it seems like they should broadly apply that to ISPs and to you know, companies who are platforms for the ideas. And it seems like from a First Amendment perspective, especially if, you know, if this is Kavanaugh's stance on, you know, if the medium through which your content is delivered is a violation of the First Amendment, surely, you know, a government saying that you have to publish or have to not publish from Google would be a violation, that they can't control what goes on their own platform. If the First Amendment applies to companies, then they're saying that you have to publish something that you otherwise wouldn't want to publish. And that seems like, under those principles, at least, if that's how the First Amendment is interpreted, then that would be a violation as well.
Okay, I want everybody to just sort of bookmark in their minds the fact that Judge Kavanaugh, in this dissent, specifically, you know, again, he gave himself the wiggle room with, if you can show sufficient market power, but then went on to say that if you can't, you've got to take a hands-off approach to things like the Drudge Report or Twitter or YouTube, as far as what content they're putting on their site, because as we know, the president and the attorney general have been making noises this week about, well, there will be a meeting of state attorneys general later this month to discuss a growing concern that Silicon Valley companies may be hurting competition and intentionally stifling the free exchange of ideas on their platforms. We're going to get to that and discuss it in more detail in a moment. But before we go there, before we get to First Amendment in depth, one thing I wanted to mention that we haven't mentioned on the show yet is an important Supreme Court decision from the state of California. That it was called Dynamex, and it came out in May of this year, and it's indicative of this ongoing push and pull back and forth about how gig economy workers are to be classified, because it makes a big difference for the workers themselves and the companies and the taxes are owed and the benefits that must be provided to the workers. The Dynamex case made it much, much harder to classify a gig economy worker as an independent contractor and laid out what's called an ABC test that makes it very hard for companies like Uber, for example, to treat their workers as independent contractors anymore. Of course, it's not limited to ride-sharing companies. It's any company that previously has relied on an independent contracting working relationship. And it's not just California doing this. In New York, I think it was the labor board there that decided after a huge push from the taxi drivers in New York that the ride-sharing workers there should be treated as employees. And also, this in Brazil, there's been a judicial ruling that a driver for Uber should be treated as an employee, and Uber's going to appeal that. So this seems to be not just a U.S. phenomenon, but a global phenomenon. Courts and labor organizations and regulatory bodies wanting gig economy companies to treat their workers as employees, which means they have to deal with the tax situation differently. They have to pay benefits. It's far more onerous for the company to treat a worker as an employee. And I think there are arguments to be made on both sides as to whether this is the right thing or not, since what we're talking about in the gig economy is not really something that we've seen before. Obviously, we don't want companies taking advantage of workers. Yet there are, swaths of workers who people of both opinions, right? You get people who are organizing, want to have more sort of union protections, want to have more sort of labor protections for the kind of work they're doing for these companies. And then you get others who like the independence of not being an employee. So this is all continuing to play itself out. Matt, any thoughts?
Just to remember that it's not just a legal issue in the distinction between an employee and an independent contractor, but it's also a political issue because it's under the Fair Labor Standards Act that's defining this, which is interpreted by your executive branch. So in 2015, the Obama administration released a statement, at least I think it was just a statement saying that they interpreted nearly anybody who is being employed as a employee and not an independent contractor. And the Trump administration, in its first couple days of office, revoked this notice to the world, essentially, that this was not the case anymore. So for looking at a judicial opinion, you're going to see, because of Chevron deference to the administrators, you're going to see interpretations change based upon who's in political office. So not only is a difficult a difficult distinction to nail down from the outset, it's also something that's subject to change.
Mm-hmm. Reverb Mike raises a really good point in IRC. He says, first he says disrupting the disruptors, and then aren't the Uber drivers simply using an app just like the Uber customers? And that actually winds up being an important point. Nobody's litigated that out in court, but I think that we will see the argument made as more and more of these cases start to come through in the wake of this Dynamex decision in California, an argument that this isn't an employment situation at all. It's a technological relationship. I don't know how far that will go, but you're right to call that out as an argument. The other interesting thing that we stumbled across and that Stefan was laughing about before the show is just how much this has changed in what feels like a really short time. I spotted this and put it in our rundown from Benedict Evans' newsletter, which I've featured as a resource of the week before. It's great. And he found, speaking of bloggers and the importance of their writings and where they feature and how they pop up over time, there was a cab driver way back in September 16th of 2010. Tell us what happened there, Stefan.
What happened in the 2010 cab driver?
Yeah, what did he write?
Oh boy, I don't remember. I read the article. I don't remember specifically what he wrote. I mean, I remember my own reaction to reading this article just because I started daydreaming about 2010 and my early interactions with Uber and how, being at a party and meeting a bunch of the engineers who were working on it and that kind of thing. So I have to embarrassedly confess that I forget the specific anecdote because I went off on my own tangent upon reading that.
Oh, that's quite all right. That happens to me all the time. So what he did, and this was from the Phantom Cab Driver Fights Back, is the name of the blog. And he was just kind of doing a rundown of recent developments that are of interest to his fellow cab drivers, his or her fellow cab drivers. And he mentioned that there had been, the Taxi Advisory Council had a meeting. And during public comment, a driver brought up something called Uber Cab, which had just been written about and really publicized, probably for one of the very first times, by Mike Erickson at TechCrunch. And the blogger here calls it an illegal high-tech taxi service that is using San Francisco as a beta test before going into other markets, and then goes on to talk about numerous other things that happened at the Taxi Advisory Council. But I just thought it was fascinating that that 2010 does not feel that long ago, but having someone mention this as just like a passing thing that was doing a beta test makes it feel like it was quite some time ago indeed. And the fact that he immediately knee-jerk decided it was illegal.
So a couple quick points on this, because it's really a fascinating discussion, and the whole employee independent contractor distinction is really interesting from a legal and, as Matt pointed out, political perspective. And I think it's really easy for us to kind of go down those rabbit holes and start thinking about this like lawyers and being really technical about it. And I think that's all healthy and good and makes kind of the, makes good sense for why we're doing that. I think somebody on the chat board, said, well, aren't these guys just using apps? And I think Denise, you pointed out that, that's a technological question, not really an employment situation. And I think what that speaks to in part is just how great the PR battle has been for some of these companies, because, pitched at that level of abstraction, you could say the same thing about a construction worker. I'm just a guy holding the hammer, standing here.
Yes.
And I'm having a technological relationship with the hammer. And yeah, maybe some money changes hands at some point and somebody's getting rich off of this, but that's not what this is about. This is about just me and a hammer. And it really is, to me, it goes back to another point about Uber that I wanted to make, which is, or not Uber, just, these companies in general. When I was younger, I was in Eastern Europe once and I was going to take a cab and someone's like, oh, no, don't take a taxi. You just call one of these off the books people and they'll come pick you up. And it sounded so incredibly sketchy, like the beginning of a horror movie. And then lo and behold, now everybody does that. And I was back in Eastern Europe a little while ago. And at that point, calling somebody off the books and getting into their car didn't seem so horrendous anymore. And right. I think what that speaks, and kind of like the PR point, if you put a nice user interface on something, whatever the behavior you're engaging in that may have seemed sketchy to you before now seems great and revolutionary and very, very exciting. And I think, again, I don't say this to be cynical. I just mean, you know, think about the power of PR and think about the power of good user interface design and how it might change your behavior and your sort of change your assumptions about a particular social construct that may have seemed unpleasant before. And so I just think it's really interesting. I mean, apart from the technical discussions of you know, are they employees or are they independent contractors, which I think nobody really thinks about when they engage with these services, think about the PR and think about the user interface design and think about, you know, what kind of society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a society where, you know, everyone is just trying to get something for free and there's no consequences, you know, people's livelihoods are being destroyed and that doesn't matter at all to you? Maybe, I mean, but that's kind of that's what the battle is about, I think, is, you know, do we have a race to the bottom or do we try to legislate this in some way? And if we're going to legislate it, you know, what are the terms that we're going to try to insert into that new social construct that emerges as the technology changes? So I think it's fascinating without sort of taking a position on it one way or the other.
Right. And I think our discussion last week about consent apps plays into this as well, because that seems to be a place where the line has been drawn and people just haven't, you know, jumped into those the way they've jumped into ride sharing apps to streamline their consent around an intimate relationship, and probably for good reason. Although I did hear from one of our listeners about remember we talked about there was a law in Sweden where consent has to be given now before that's the default, that if you can show that you have to be able to show that consent was given or you may be in trouble. And so there's a new consent app that is specifically targeted at the Swedish population to deal with their new law. And the listener who chimed in on my Twitter said, you know, I mean, maybe it's a better idea to put the burden on showing that consent existed rather than that it didn't. In other words, the law shifts the burdens in a way that makes sense for society, that we should assume that it's not present until it can be shown to exist. And there's some good logic to that. It's worth going back to the Mike Arrington piece that the blogger pointed to on August 31st, 2010, just about 8 years ago, where Uber was still called Uber Cab. And Mike says they had first covered it in July of that year. And he is just frothy with excitement about the potential for this. He is not thinking it's a creepy way to have a stranger give him a ride. He's thinking that it's going to be just like Airbnb for homes and Square for credit card transactions. Turns out he read that right, that that's how people mostly embraced ride-sharing apps and companies and technology, and he was very pleased with the convenience of it, with the fact that there was an incentive to compete for your service experience that you didn't get with the taxi world that existed at that time. So it's an interesting snapshot to go back and look at that. Anybody have any thoughts before we move on?
No, Matt? just a quick. I read through the comments of this article, and amazingly, they were on point. I've never read a comment section where I felt like I gained a lot from it. But they drew the battle lines of saying, you know, the incumbent cab licensors were saying, well, this is illegal, and we're going to win on the law. And you saw some, you know, a couple other individuals chime in and say, no, you need to make this product, otherwise you're going to die. Because ultimately, like, people want better service, and they'll, like, the law be damned, they're going to get better service. And, you know, the cabbie's reaction was, no, this is illegal, this doesn't matter, like, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, kudos to the commenters back in 2010. Maybe it was just a better breed back then.
Yep, we can only hope. Maybe they're making a comeback. All right, let's put our first MCLE passphrase into the show, and let's make it Good comments in 2010. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional who needs to receive continuing education in your field. Sometimes oversight boards like to see that you actually watched or listened to the show. So we put these phrases in to assist with that process. Our first one will be good comments in 2010. We'll put another one in before the end of the show. If you are a lawyer, you can head on over to, in the United States, that is, you can head over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, find This Week in Law there, and we've got a chart with some information about how you might go about applying for credit in your jurisdiction. All right. I've alluded to the First Amendment discussions going on in Washington, D.C. this week. Let's talk about those next. All right, so we have various folks who are concerned about things that are going on the technological platforms that they and others use. And there seems to be this sentiment, particularly on the right, that it goes something like this, that technology companies headquartered in, emanating out of Silicon Valley, have leadership that has a particular political bias, and that perhaps that means that that affects the policies being applied by the companies as they decide what content to permit or not permit on their sites. And what we've seen this week is the Justice Department, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, saying that he's going to convene a meeting of the state attorneys general later this month to discuss a growing concern that these companies may be hurting competition and intentionally stifling the free exchange of ideas on their platforms. So that's two different points. Hurting competition sounds much more resonant with that market power point, absent a showing of market power, Judge Kavanaugh kept saying, that was raised earlier in the show. And then we have this notion of intentionally stifling the free exchange of ideas on their platforms. So that hasn't happened yet. There's just been an announcement that there would be a meeting between the federal attorney general's office and all of the state attorneys general on this point. Now, some of the anecdotal concerns that have been raised about this remind me a lot, speaking of the early years of blogging again, of the sort of throwing up our hands and hand-wringing that bloggers would do every single time Google decided to rejigger its PageRank algorithm, which meant we would all lose our Google juice. We would all, you know, various oncoming links. So there used to actually be a rank, and you might slip in your page rank, and people just thought this was terrible. But what never came out at that point, and I think what people should bear in mind as they think through this, is that it was never content based. It was all about Google deciding how it was going to deliver the most relevant results to the search query in question. And they've fine-tuned that over the years. That is its business model, to provide search. I've sort of chuckled and think that some people, like Maria Bartiromo, for example, when she's complaining about various tweets that aren't getting traction, are reliving what we went through, the agony of bloggers in the early years. That, yeah, every now and then the tech companies rejigger how they do things and readjust and try and improve, and that it doesn't always feel good when it's happening. But I have huge questions about this notion that there's any sort of content-based filtering going on by any of these folks. And of course, they all deny it. So that's one question. The other question, the one that we bring up often on the show, and the one I'd like to get into in more depth here, is to what extent does the government have anything at all to say about this? Getting back to what Jeff Sessions' office said again, does the government have any role in deciding, enacting regulations about whether a private social media platform is, quote unquote, intentionally stifling the free exchange of ideas? And let's go a little more deeply on that and talk first about the First Amendment, which is where our notion of freedom of speech and free expression comes from, and how it works and how it may work in the future if folks continue to go down this road. So Matt, closest to law school of the three of us, can you give us a quick primer on the First Amendment?
Yeah, the primer on the First Amendment is that the text says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. So it was originally written only for Congress, and the states retained police powers of which they could limit speech. So you could have limitations on, you know, the states could limit what you could say, what you could publish. You know, there was even limitations on the press within states back before really the 1910s, 1920s. Justice Holmes was instrumental in bringing the First Amendment to including it within the 14th Amendment, which therefore makes it active against the states. So states therefore cannot also abridge the freedom of speech. And it's been interpreted very broadly, but what it has not been interpreted as is something that the government can use and say that even the largest public forum, you know, if you think historically, you know, you may have been the New York Times, you know, pre the internet, to say that you have to publish equal amounts of ideas about, you know, all sorts of things. So, and I just don't think that the application applies that a private company, even if Google said we will not publish anything that a Republican would ever like tomorrow, I the First Amendment still does not apply. You know, there's all sorts of other ramifications for that. There's there's copyright actual limitations because you have a safe harbor if you do not sort of pre-sort what ideas are being published. But if they're looking after the fact and saying that anyone who publishes an idea that I don't like isn't allowed on my site, like, there's no First Amendment protection against that. And it doesn't seem like there should be. Realistically, though, that'd be a terrible business decision. And it seems like, you know, at once the Republicans want – these companies to not ban these types of speeches, but they're also actively asking them to ban speeches of radical, what is considered radical Islam or radical speech that incites violence or terrorism. And it's a really hard line to draw. You know, is it, do you just base it upon, you know, the religion or the political fever of who's looking at it and try to justify that. So I think it's a really, really hard line they're doing. But there's tons of things that the government can do to make these companies' business harder or make it politically difficult. But I don't think it imputes the First Amendment at all.
Right. And we've mentioned that numerous times on the show, that people have this impression that the First Amendment applies to all speech in all places, all platforms, that as Americans, we have this right to our freedom of expression. And really what the First Amendment says is the government cannot abridge your speech. So by definition, a private company can. There are some nuances in First Amendment jurisprudence that have to do with when something has become a public forum. And if you have exclusive access to that public forum, then you must make sure that access is handed out evenly. The First Amendment can kick in. This is a narrow realm of First Amendment jurisprudence, but it seems to be where we may be headed with both judicially and perhaps from a law enforcement standpoint with the state and federal attorneys general. What were you going to say, Matt?
I think that those have been applied to situations where the government is limiting the access mm-hmm. to the public forum. So like I think the 2016 North Carolina Supreme Court case where North Carolina was trying to limit sex offenders from being on Facebook or social media, Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion that it was so inherent to the dignity of being human that, you know, to be able to speak and learn and be on social media, that this was a basic human right, essentially, and that therefore the government could not restrict you from being on there. That's different, though, than saying that the government can't restrict you from access to Facebook or Google is different than mm-hmm. saying that Google has to allow you to be on there.
It's very different. But what the latter case reminds me of is some of the other First Amendment jurisprudence. And again, it's not this is sort of a narrow exception to the broader rule that it's just the government that can't restrict your speech. But there's some real property related principles, too, where if you are the private controller of access to the public square, you have to allow access to the public square. And I'm talking about a physical public square here. So when we start talking about social media platforms as a public square, which the Supreme Court has done in that case that you mentioned, that was Packingham versus North Carolina in 2017, we begin to crawl into the heads of our lawmakers and law enforcers and see where this may go. Justice Kennedy wrote in the majority there was access to what for many are the principal sources for knowing current events, checking ads for employment, speaking and listening in the modern public square, and otherwise exploring the vast realms of human thought and knowledge. In sum, he concludes, to foreclose access to social media altogether is to prevent the user from engaging in the legitimate exercise of First Amendment rights. So again, that case fits within what we're talking about. The government can't say, oh, you're a sex offender, so you can't use social media. But I think with that now, you know, precedent from the Supreme Court and with the discussions that are going on in D.C. right now, we might see some momentum toward treating these companies more like gatekeepers. And again, getting back to that market forces aspect that was raised not only by Judge Kavanaugh in that older decision that we referenced earlier, but just this week from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. They are going to convene a meeting to discuss a growing concern that these companies may be hurting competition. So, you know, why do we talk about hurting competition and intentionally stifling the free exchange of ideas on their platforms in the same breath? I think it might be because there's going to be some argument that you have a stranglehold on the public square. That's my speculation.
Yeah, I think that they're also trying to bring in, and I'm not too familiar with this area of law, but they're trying to bring in antitrust violations so that they could break them up, which would have the effect of saying that if you don't let people in, we're going to bring antitrust violations on it. That would be the same. You know, your effect would be that they would let Alex Jones still be on there. But I think that legally that seems what they're trying to do, although I'm no antitrust expert.
Right. And Professor Goldman, who we've had on the show many times, was interviewed for one of the pieces we have in our rundown this week. That's tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 433. If you want to read all of these pieces we looked at, Professor Goldman said, where is his quote? It would be troublesome to use antitrust law as a guise for regulating speech. He specifically said, this statement makes me think antitrust is not the real goal, that the real goal is censorship. This could be broad action by the government to try to subvert the First Amendment. So we could see that playing out. And the other thing to just kind of throw into the calculus here that we haven't mentioned yet is the way in which Silicon Valley has grown and thrived. And again, speaking of Professor Goldman, because he's one of the foremost scholars in the world on this act, the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which provides the safe harbor for companies that shields them from liability for the actions, many of the illegal actions, not all of them, but many of the illegal actions of their users. That is really why we've been able to see these companies grow. If they were to get sued every time a defamatory thing is uttered on Twitter, then they wouldn't be able to exist. And that is something that lawmakers like Senator Ted Cruz seem to know very well, because what he has been pointing out in the context of this discussion is that in order to enjoy the protections of the Communications Decency Act and that safe harbor there, you have to be a neutral public forum for that's the standard under the act. So I think that we may see some impetus to try and establish, you know, some sort of evidence of non-neutrality in the content moderation and management aspect. Again, I think that's going to be really hard to show. I think what we're talking about is much more like readjusting the PageRank algorithm. That's not done on a politically motivated way. It's purely an algorithm that tries to look at relevance, however. But when you start parsing what's relevant to whom, maybe, you know, it's like your argument, Stefan, about whether I'm just here with a hammer. Maybe when you get down to the semantics of it, there's something that they'll be able to discuss here. What do you think?
Well, first, you've mentioned a couple times this issue of market power. And one thing I'm wondering about with regard to that is, you know, what's the relevant market that we're talking about? If you're talking about ISPs versus apps, I think it's a big difference, because let's say you live in the Smoky Mountains somewhere in rural Tennessee. I'm guessing there aren't seven service providers that you can choose from on your broadband connection front. You probably have one, and mm-hmm. in that market that's relevant to you, all the power exists in that one service provider's hands. Once you have that connection, you can download any app you want, presumably. I mean, I don't know what the effects of the repeal of net neutrality are going to be on that, but that's another topic. So assuming you have access to internet, you can download whatever you want. And I think slicing and dicing the market is much more complicated on the app front than it is on the ISP front, because you know, you could look at the market on a national basis for ISPs, but that would make no sense, because where I live in Seattle, I have, I believe it's basically two options. Those same two options may or may not exist in Atlanta or Minnesota or wherever. And it just doesn't make sense to talk about markets in a national way when you're talking about ISPs. Now, apps, you know, maybe there's a better justification at that point because of that fluidity across jurisdictions, and because it's not tied to any particular place. And so anytime I hear somebody invoke market power, I kind of start thinking, okay, well, define that for me, because I'm truly confused about how you mean it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I guess my only other thought on this point is that, you know, as the federal attorney general and the state attorneys general get ready to meet, someone should write them a memo that says, by the way, the potential soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh thinks that unless you can show that kind of market power, quote-unquote, the government must keep its hands off the editorial decisions of internet service providers. And he goes on to include in his definition of internet service providers Amazon, various blogs, Twitter, and Drudge Report. So his point there was that's his whole free speech argument, is that it is a private commercial speech argument, that your actions as a company in making those decisions are, and again, many scholars considered this a throwaway argument, but not this particular federal judge, an exercise of First Amendment constitutionally protected rights. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as conservatives move more towards both originalism and intervention in the market, they're going to have a trouble having their justices uphold their political decisions because originalism isn't going to extend the First Amendment beyond, you know, to a private company, even though you may politically want to hammer Google and Facebook as much as you want. You're going to be overturned if you put more originalists on the Supreme Court.
And Stefan, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I not to sound like a first year law student, but just to kind of throw a hypothetical back to Judge Kavanaugh here, to my point about market share. If under his analysis there, if the five major cable companies, you know, ISPs were to divide up the country and each take a chunk of it and become the, you know, sole provider in that chunk of the country, and then you were to apply a market analysis where you look at, you know, nationally, what does the internet market look like? You know, how does that resolve the controversy in Judge Kavanaugh's view? Because you could say, well, look, there's five ISPs and they're competing nationally and they all have 20% of the market. And so nobody has market dominance. But if in each region of the country there's only one provider, then as a practical matter, there's just sort of five effective monopolies that have in a sort of cartel fashion divided up the country. And so under those circumstances, how does that impact the First Amendment analysis that Judge Kavanaugh proposes? It's really hard for me to see the legal principle there, and I see it almost more so as a political statement that's sort of masquerading as a legal principle. And I agree with Matt that there's an inherent contradiction baked into the conservative analysis at this point between the originalists and the interventionists. And I'm not sure how they're going to resolve that one. I think maybe there's some political expediency in taking the stand right now, but they're going to pay for it down the road if they stay down this path.
Yep. Interesting stuff. All right. We will continue to take a look at that. But right now, let's take a look at some graffiti. Stefan, you have a couple of posts up on your firm's The TMCA blog about graffiti, its status as protectable copyrighted art, but then the artists themselves being upset when it is photographed and reused. Can you explain that in more detail for us?
Yeah, so the case that I wrote about is called Faulkner versus General Motors, and I'm going to do one of those fancy disclaimers and say I used to work for General Motors, and I don't know if I'm under any obligation to say that, but I think it's fun to do it anyway. So full disclosure, I used to work for General Motors.
It's very fancy.
Yeah. So it was Faulkner is an artist. He's a graffiti artist from Switzerland, I believe. Goes by the name Smash 137, and he does murals and installations all over the world, and he's sort of like a high-end graffiti artist. And he painted a mural on the side of a garage in Detroit, and you can see that mural if you go to the blog and look up the story from August 8th. And you can see, in fact, a part of the mural. You don't see the whole thing in that picture. And so he painted this mural on a garage, and a photographer who was not employed by General Motors, but an independent photographer, came to Detroit, and he was a photographer who was sort of media savvy, and he knew about a policy that major car companies have, which is that you can essentially request a car from the car company, drive it around, take pictures of the car, and then submit your pictures to the company, and then that company can make a decision with whether or not they want to use those pictures in a media campaign. And that's what ended up happening here. He took a picture of the Cadillac that he had borrowed from GM, parked in front of the mural. He submitted it to General Motors, and then General Motors used it in an online marketing campaign. And so Faulkner, the artist, then sued General Motors and not the photographer. And he essentially accused General Motors of infringing his copyright by distributing this image that he has without his consent. And so this led to a very quick motion for summary judgment by General Motors, essentially arguing that under an exemption that is baked into the Architectural Works Copyright Protection Act of 1990, photography of architectural works is exempt from copyright infringement lawsuits on the basis that essentially Congress didn't want to turn every photographer into an infringer. And so when you go around and you take pictures and you take pictures of buildings, though those buildings may have certain copyright protections, you can't infringe that protection by taking a picture of the building. Now, the interesting thing about this case and the sort of question underlying it is, while that may be true of the buildings, what happens to any kind of pictures or sculptures that are embedded in the buildings? And under what circumstances does this exemption that allows photography of the building also cover sculptures or pictures or anything that's painted onto the side of the building? Does a separate copyright holder not have the ability to assert copyright infringement under those circumstances? Now, this might sound like a fairly simple question, but when you dig into the law on it, it's actually a much more complicated and unresolved issue than I think anyone expected. And so now we've gotten to the point where this has been briefed. There was oral arguments held on August 27th, and now we're just waiting for an order from the court. And the fundamental issue at the heart of this decision is going to be, how does the court interpret a Ninth Circuit decision from the year 2000 called Leicester? And in that decision, the Ninth Circuit dealt with a very similar set of facts, except instead of a piece of graffiti, it was a series of sculptures that were embedded into a building that were then photographed while the movie Batman was being filmed. And you know, there was a challenge at that point. And the designer of the sculptures ended up losing, and the filmmakers ended up winning, and they were found not to infringe the sculptor's copyright. The difference there was the sculptures were inherently a part of the building that had been photographed, whereas in this case, the graffiti was painted onto the building afterwards. And so you get into this question of conceptual separability and whether or not the doctrine of conceptual separability survived the enactment of the Architectural Copyright Works Protection Act of 1999, or whether that act essentially preempted the doctrine. So I'm happy to get into the weeds on that. I don't want to kind of lose the thread if I've spoken for too long without taking a break here. So I'll let you guys weigh in or ask questions, or I can just keep going. Let me know.
I have a question, actually. Yeah. How does all of this relate to the lawsuit that we covered here on the show last year? And I've been looking to see if there's been any resolution of it, and I'm not finding one. About this time last year, a court decided the lawsuit could go forward, and I'm not sure if it ever got resolved or tried or settled or what happened. But it involved Richard Prince, who is a person who... he's an artist. He's an appropriation artist, and this particular lawsuit involved him taking people's Instagram works, blowing them up and displaying them in a gallery, and selling his, you know, appropriated calling out of other people's Instagram posts for thousands of dollars. And so he got himself sued, and I'm not quite sure whatever happened with that. I'll dig into it more after the show and see if I can figure out if that's still pending. But it seems similar, although it doesn't involve the architectural aspect.
Yeah, I think the architectural aspect here makes it unique because there's a very clear policy goal that Congress had in 1990. And then you got to think about, you know, 1990, not everybody had a cell phone with a camera on it, and there was no Instagram. And so this prevalence of people walking around taking pictures and posting them and sharing them, and then having this fine line between, you know, what is a marketing post and what isn't a marketing post. I don't think that was blurred in 1990 the way that it is now with, let's say, influencers who make their money posing in front of buildings in fancy shoes. You know, what happens if you put on a pair of fancy shoes, you go stand in front of a mural, you get your picture taken, you post it on your Instagram account. You get into all sorts of weird questions about copyright and what's fair use at that point. And so I think the architectural aspect here is distinct because there's a very clear policy reason why you would want people to be able to freely walk around taking pictures outside without worrying about being sued for copyright infringement. At the same time, there's no dispute that before this act was enacted, somebody who painted graffiti would have had copyright protection in it. So essentially, GM is in the position of arguing that the architectural protections that came into effect in 1990 took away the rights of mural artists and others who make art and that is sort of attached to buildings, essentially caused them to lose the protections that they had before that act came into place. And that's a counterintuitive argument. And I think my own view on this is this decision that's going to come down from the district court and the Central District of California is probably not going to resolve it. I think this is going to go back up to the Ninth Circuit to try to get some clarity on the law here, because there's really no way to read the statute and the current authority interpreting it and come out to a clear consensus on what it actually means and how it impacts the rights of graffiti artists. And so I personally find this to be really fascinating. I think it implicates a lot of very kind of technical legal questions at the same time as it implicates very intuitive policy questions. And so I think being able to look at both at the same time here is going to be important for the judge when the decision comes down.
Right. And hopefully the artists will look up this Richard Prince controversy and get some inspiration, because some of the people whose work had been appropriated by Richard Prince, particularly the Suicide Girls, one of their works was appropriated and then sold by this artist for $90,000. They then in turn did their own version of the side by side of the $90,000 version and the original version, and they sold those for $90, and they sold 8,000 of them and donated the profits to the EFF. So maybe the graffiti artist needs to start taking pictures of the people taking pictures of the graffiti and then making graffiti out of those pictures, and maybe there's some sort of recursive circle that will go on and on forever.
So during oral arguments, it was interesting. GM sort of backed off of its hardline position that it took in the briefing, and it sort of mm-hmm. tried to have it both ways. It said, you know, if you get in, it sort of, they didn't quite say this, but essentially what they were implying was that if you get in, you know, really close and you just take a picture of the mural, you know, that's one thing. But if you take mm-hmm. a picture of the building and you see the building and the mural, then that's another. And so I think there's, you know, that kind of slicing and dicing and trying to find, okay, what is the right amount of infringement that I can get away with here before I'm outside of the protections of the Architectural Works Act may end up featuring in the decision. But frankly, I don't see how you read the statute and you read the authority interpreting it now and get a clear answer. So maybe the Suicide Girls can help here. I'm not sure if not sure if the clerk has a beat on that, but if not, you know, maybe they listen to the show and they can get an insight from there.
Yeah, maybe they can. All right. Any thoughts, Matt?
Just one quick question. The doctrine of conceptual separability, what does that hinge on? And then the second question that was just kind of dawned upon me when I was reading this is, if I just graffiti on, you know, my neighbor's door, do I own a copyright in that? Or does my illegal action somehow bar me from a copyright?
So on the first question, the doctrine of conceptual separability pre-exists the Architectural Works Copyright Protection Act, and I believe its origins are in this notion that, you know, if you have a utilitarian structure, utilitarian item that doesn't have any copyright protection on it, if you have a conceptually separate item on top of it and they're integrated, you can get a copyright protection in that sort of creative work that's attached to the utilitarian work. So that's kind of the origin of the doctrine. And in the context that it's being litigated in here, the question is, you know, if you've got sort of a standalone creative element that is just attached to a building, can that standalone item have an independent life as a copyrightable item? So, for instance, if you were to build a very functional shed, for example, and then put a really ornate, beautiful gargoyle on top of your plain shed, not that anybody would do that. It's obviously trashy and hideous. But if you were to go ahead and do that, you know, does the artist who made the gargoyle have a conceptually separate work? And I think I'm not sure off the top of my head what the inquiry there is to determine it, but it's essentially that attempt to distinguish the utilitarian feature from the creative feature and give rights to the person who created the creative feature. So in the context of this particular dispute, the doctrine is being interpreted in a slightly different way, and that's actually a part of the litigation, is whether the doctrine is even appropriately recited here. But the issue is, you know, there's no debate if you have a beautiful stained glass window, for instance, and you put that into the parking garage, you know, that may end up getting integrated, and when you take a picture of that, you could have the exemption apply because you've got a total, you know, you've got one structure there and it's protected by copyright and the stained glass window is integrated into it. If you come along after and put a graffiti mural on it, it's separate from the building. It's not made in connection with the architect who made the building, and it's just sort of an add-on. Is that sufficiently separate to then warrant separate treatment under the law? And I think it's an attempt to take a doctrine that kind of arose under different circumstances and graft it onto this particular statute. And if you read the decision, Lancaster, there's you know, three separate opinions. There's the majority, the concurring opinion, and the dissent. They all take vastly different views, and the opinion really doesn't provide any clear guidance on this. And it's an interesting read if you want to take a deep dive on that question. So hopefully that answers your question there. On the second question, you know, one of the features of this exemption is it has to be photographs are only exempt if they're from a publicly viewable location. So, you know, if your neighbor's door is in a private spot, you trespass to get to it, you put the graffiti on the door and then you take a picture of it, that's arguably not going to be exempt because it's not publicly viewable and you've trespassed to get there. So that's outside of the statute. So I should have been a little bit more clear there that this only applies if the building is publicly viewable. In terms of whether or not trespass impacts your rights on the more foundational level, I'm actually not sure. That's a good question. It would shock me if it would, though, because at the end of the day, you're fixing a creative work in somewhere, and I don't see why the trespass would impact that.
Interesting.
All right. Well, speaking of creativity and copyright, let's do our last story, which involves Hollywood. So if you've been noticing that the political rhetoric in our country has been hot and pointed, in the copyright arena, there's really no escape because we learned recently that Creative Future, which is an alliance that represents more than 520 or companies and organizations in film, TV, music, and publishing, and is aligned with the Copyright Alliance as well. They are both in favor of strong copyright and et cetera. They outline all that on their mission statement. They took it upon themselves to pick out a listing that Google had posted for a job opening that I think we might have actually mentioned on the show before, way back in, I think it was February of this year. Fred Von Lohman left Google as its legal director for copyright issues. And I think I mentioned it, the listing on the show. I know I tweeted it, thinking that people who watch and listen to This Week in Law might be the kind of people who might be a good new head of copyright for Google. So might want to know about the listing. Well, Creative Future caught wind of the listing and decided to troll Google a bit and redraft it as they say, we've taken the liberty of making these edits for you, presented below as red line corrections to the original document. The red line corrections change the job opening and qualifications, et cetera, to say that if you want this job, you have to basically be able to trample on everyone's copyrights. You can read it for yourself, but it's very snarky and kind of mean-spirited. And at Google itself, the only action it's taken in response is simply to take down the job listing, which I don't know if that means it has been filled or they just don't want it to be out there as bait for this kind of trolling anymore. But I will mention that I did do my own bit of trolling about it, not so much trolling, but just lamenting I believe Fred von Lohmann may have drafted the original text himself, and so I tweeted at him that I was prepared to be so here for it when the preferred qualifications for Google's next head of copyright included listens to This Week in Law, but alas, it did not. And Fred came in and told me, oh, that he'd forgotten that important qualification. So I hope that that still is an actual qualification for this job opening. Matt, did you take a look at this?
Yeah, no, I thought it was good, well-felt heckling that a shout across the bow at Google, and that's all in good fun. And it seems like, you know, Fred's interaction with you was pretty special.
All right, Stefan, any thoughts about either taking the shot or not responding to the shot?
I just feel sorry for the head of Bing's copyright division. I mean, what, you know, nobody's taking shots at him. So I think.
Yeah, it's true. Too bad for Bing. They can only
they
hope that someday.
Twill.
Yeah. Someday that the, what are they called again? The Creative Coalition will decide to take them down too. All right. And then I guess we have one other story along those lines, because I did take a quick look to see if I could find the original listing in the Wayback Machine. I couldn't. I didn't look through every single potential Internet Archive entry that where it could exist. It could exist back there somewhere. And you can find the link to the original in my tweet. But let's talk about the Internet Archive before we wrap up the show. An interesting and obscure and yet important little evidentiary tidbit is, in general, getting evidence in a trial is a pretty onerous thing. You have to be able to demonstrate that the evidence is trustworthy and credible. And listener James Russo pointed out to me that there have been a couple of federal court decisions now, circuit court decisions, where documents archived in the Internet Archive, in the Wayback Machine, have been admissible in court, that they've met all of the qualifications to be admissible evidence in a trial, which I think is really important as we move forward as a society. So much of what counts as something evidentiary probably appeared on the web in one form or another. And the Internet Archive does its level best to keep track of that, even though things get pulled down. So it's probably a good development to know that if you need to look to the Wayback Machine for evidence, there is at least a bit of federal precedent that you should be able to use it. Stefan, any thoughts?
So I've used the Wayback Machine in litigation before. I've never tried to get anything admitted at trial from that archive, but you know it's a great tool if, for example, you're litigating against a consumer electronics company and you want to see what they had, you know, what they were offering for sale at a specific point in time, and it can be useful just for investigation purposes. I remember the interface being a little unwieldy at the time that I was using it. And I frankly, maybe I haven't used it in a while. Maybe it's improved. So, you know, maybe you can get that reliability now that was lacking at the time. But the Wayback Machine is certainly a great tool. It remains to be seen, I think, whether it's broadly adopted as an evidentiary database. But it's encouraging to me, again, that courts are accepting new technologies and thinking substantively about whether or not they're reliable rather than just dismissing them. So it's great.
Yeah. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah. I don't know anything about evidence, nor had I heard of the Wayback Machine. I do love the name, and it seems like a very, you know, it seems like otherwise you'd have to rely on, you know, some picture that you'd taken or, you know, on opposing counsel to generate their old, you know, consumer product web page from previously. So it seems like a great neutral setting to get information about what was being said at a certain time in history.
If I could just add one more thing, to kind of be a little dweeby about it for a second. You know, the internet is always speaking in the present tense, it seems, because every time you load a website, you're loading it and there it is. It's kind of like that journalistic present tense. And the Wayback Machine allows you to kind of like insert this alternate reality where now you're speaking in the past tense. And there's something just slightly weird about like using the tool, because you go onto it and it's like you're traveling through time, and try it out sometime. It's very odd to go to a website that you recognize in its current manifestation and look at it in its old manifestation, because you start to notice all the different UI elements and how they've gradually sort of transformed over time, and you've just kind of gone along with it at every stage. It's almost like hearing a song you haven't heard for a while and kind of being transported to a moment in time. So it is a fun little exercise for those of us who spend way too much time on the internet to kind of jog our memories and see what it used to be like.
Right. And I guess that gives us our second MCLE passphrase for the show, which is going to be Mr. Peabody. If you remember that the original Wayback Machine was from a Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon that starred Mr. Peabody and Sherman. So Mr. Peabody gets to be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And yeah, I mean, substantively, I think that so much communication happens online these days that if you're going to have an evidentiary trail of how something was marketed or communicated or described, you've got to be able to get those Wayback Machine pages into evidence. All right, let's move on to an animal selfie of the week, courtesy of a different listener, Tim Chase on Twitter, who goes by @gumnos, G-U-M-N-O-S. All right, so our animal selfie this week is a great one. I'm going to just go ahead and let it play while I talk over it. It is not our first seagull stealing a GoPro, but it is a very, very good one. And it was posted by Ron Balky, who is, he's described himself as a space explorer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I don't know if this is his own video. But he has posted a very, very naughty seagull who has made off with the camera and flown around with it to great effect. I mean, the seagull gets some great footage, not just of itself, but various scenic aerial views, and then seems to bring it back to the owner, which seems like it's not only a seagull, but perhaps a homing seagull. So thank you very much, Rocket Ron, Ron Balky on Twitter, for posting this, and also our listener, Tim Chase, for our this week's animal selfie of the week. We do these animal selfies of the week because animal selfies have figured so delightedly in copyright litigation, and people seem to still be confused about whether an animal can hold a copyright in an image it takes of itself. All right. Our tip of the week has to do with representations that get made online. It involves a case that was recently settled. I don't know if either of you gentlemen have ever encountered Gwyneth Paltrow's company Goop, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand. But among other things, she sells things that could be considered to be products related to women's health. And one of the most perplexing products she sells and markets and advocates is something called a jade egg, jade and rose quartz eggs that are used internally in a female's nether regions. And they were sued because apparently there were health statements about this practice that were not justifiable by science or medicine that were available, I presume, on the Goop website, another good use for the Wayback Machine. But our tip of the week is the statement that the company put out in connection with the settlement is that Goop provides a forum for practitioners to present their views and experiences with various products like the egg. The law, though, sometimes views statements like this as advertising claims, which are subject to various legal requirements. Basically what Goop is saying is, you know, our bad, that stuff apparently shouldn't have been on our website, but we didn't put it there. Our users did. So, it's a question that gets back to the Communications Decency Act and whether Goop should be liable for statements of its users. So our tip of the week, I guess, is if you're going to have statements about jade eggs on your website, to be careful about their origins and source. Now, it never came to a legal analysis of whether Goop would be liable for those statements they didn't put on their website. They settled the case. But it's one to just be aware of that perhaps even if you don't take it all the way to judgment, you don't want to be involved in a big old lawsuit about your jade eggs. They're going to wind up paying $145,000 in civil penalties over these statements. And of course, they have to give refunds to everyone who was affected. So that was our tip of the week. Our resource of the week goes back. This is a brand new resource that harkens back a couple of episodes ago for us when we did our blockchain and smart contract related show recently with Aaron Wright. Stanford University now has a Journal of Blockchain Law and Policy. And Volume 1, Issue 1 is available for your perusal. If you are interested in blockchain law and policy, this is going to be a wonderful thing to check in with. The current issue has topics such as cryptocurrency and the shifting IRS enforcement model, hard forks on the Bitcoin blockchain, reversible exit continuing voice, ICOs, many, many other things that I'm sure this journal will cover. So put that in your arsenal of blockchain learning. Guys, it's been really great to chat with you here today. Matt, so excited about your company and the great work you're doing.
Yeah, it's been a delightful journey, and can't say enough about, you know, our investors and Y Combinator in particular has been a wonderful experience to see other companies come through, and a couple other Bitcoin companies who I had to refrain from telling them that I despise Bitcoin, but they were really nice people, and they're off doing great things, and it'll be fun to watch their progress too.
That's great. Didn't you tell me you broke some kind of record?
Yeah, so there was a sign-up record for number of donors signed up, and we broke the world record in a day, accidentally, and that was very exciting.
It is very exciting. For folks who don't remember, or maybe weren't listening before, what are these people donating and why?
So they are signing up to donate stem cells or bone marrow for individuals who have leukemia, lymphoma, and anemia. Essentially, their stem cells have stopped functioning, and so they need a replacement. So they go through chemotherapy and need a matched donor in order to survive. So we on the basis of a legal challenge, we're able to compensate donors, and so are able to open a new marketplace where donors are, you know, it is a procedure where, you know, they have to take a couple of days off work, so we pay them for their time to go and do that. So it's important, and people are gung-ho about it, so it's really exciting.
That is really exciting. Thanks for bringing us up to speed. And Stefan Spida, great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much. And, you know, I may not be trying to cure cancer, but I am engaged in some pretty pointed meet and confer, so on discovery issues. So.
and pondering of Bolshevik philosophy, do you have anything you can offer us at the end of the show this week?
Yeah, you know, I've been reading this book about Bolshevik history, and I learned a fascinating little detail. So, of course, I got to pull up the actual name here because I'm not going to break my own streak here of mentioning the Bolsheviks. So, there was an asylum in 1930s Moscow that was called, it had some name, some official name, but it had a euphemism that it went by, which is Konochnikov's Dasha. And I think that's the greatest little euphemism ever for an asylum. A dasha is like a country house. So if somebody was sent to the psychiatric hospital under no doubt very unfortunate circumstances, they would get a letter from Konochnikov's Dasha, which is just the most serene sounding name for what must have been just a horrible place. And so there's your Bolshevik factoid of the week.
All right. Thank you so much. We also have Victor in the studio reminds me a short URL, an easy URL to access our MCLE resources now. That's at twit.to/MCLE if you're interested in getting there more quickly. What else shall I tell you? You know, we record this show as we did today at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when you can go to twit.tv and watch with us live and jump into our IRC chat room and play along with us and heckle us about the Internet Archive and Borscht and various other things, or not just heckle us. Of course, we love our IRC chatters and they are so helpful during the show. And thank you, thank you, thank you, everyone, for all of your comments during the show and all of your comments between the shows when you can and should get in touch with us and let us know your thoughts about what we discussed, your thoughts about what we might want to discuss in the future, and your thoughts about who we should have on the show as a guest. Love hearing from you. Love hearing your animal selfies and various things that you have stumbled on the internet that you know we would like here on This Week in Law and that we would like to discuss in depth and in detail, or maybe just mention because they're funny. So please do get in touch with us. I am D Howell on Twitter. Stefan is Stefan Spida there. That's StefanSzPajda. And Matt is LawPint there. So that's a great way to get in touch with us. Also, we all have emails where you can write to us in more confidentiality and at greater length. I am Denise at twit.tv. Matt is Matt at twit.tv. And we are still tinkering with Stefan's email address. So don't email him just yet because his email address isn't quite reaching him. But we're going to try and fix that in the next week or so. We'll let you know when it's active. Until next week, we hope you have a great time and continue doing good work out in the world. And we will see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.